Welcome to The Brainstorm, a podcast and video series from ARK Invest. Tune in every week as we react to the latest in innovation and reflect on how short-term news impacts our long-term views. To learn more, visit ARK-invest.com.
ARK Investment Management, LLC is an SEC-registered investment advisor. ARK and Public are unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to either firm marketing or selling the products or services of the other, and therefore ARK disclaims responsibility for any loss that may be incurred by Public's clients or customers. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. An investor should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and/or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in the show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements. ARK assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARK and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.
Welcome to The Brainstorm, episode 56. We've got Lorenzo back with us to debrief some crazy happenings with Jump Crypto. Lorenzo, can you give us a quick summary of what happened? Was it part of the yen carry trade shock, or was this something separate to crypto markets and Jump?
Yeah, it's a good question, Sam. So just to give a bit of perspective, on Monday the 5th, we had a drawdown of about more than 20%, I think, in Bitcoin and ETH, and for the altcoins, 30%+ across the board. And yeah, I mean, as many of you know, there were a lot of talks of the yen carry trade unwinding. And we had Jump Crypto, which is one of the biggest market makers and algo trading companies in the world, and also in crypto, unwinding a pretty sizable position of staked ETH and basically selling more than 300 million, depositing that into exchanges and selling that into stablecoins, which was extremely, you know, weird, I would say, the timing, obviously, with that volatility and those prices and the urgency. So it was, it was very surprising. And a lot of people in crypto were a bit afraid and also questioning the health, basically, of Jump Crypto just in general.
And so what's your take here, right? Why? What other reason would there be for them unwinding in a dramatic way on a day of chaos? Is this where there's smoke, there's fire? Or do you think this is a one-off, maybe they got caught off sides on something?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, definitely selling assets on Monday is, you know, you have to have some kind of urgency. I think the story with Jump Trading over the past couple of years, they've taken a lot of hits in general in crypto. I mean, you know, a lot of people alluded to this, but they were extremely involved with the Terra Luna collapse. So when the main market maker of Terra Luna, they also were very involved with FTX and just the Solana ecosystem in general and took a hit there. They were also, developing the Wormhole Bridge, which is a protocol in crypto that was hacked, I think, for $250 million. And they were the ones, you know, plugging the coming, you know, with the capital. And they've also been sued by the CFTC, I think, two months ago, related to Terra Luna in general. So, you know, it hasn't been great for Jump Trading for the past year and a half. And so, Yeah, some people are speculating maybe that they might, you know, shut down the crypto division as a whole. I think it's unlikely, but yeah, that's what, you know, people were speculating.
It's been a full week. It is Monday as of this recording. Has it just been silence from the Jump team? Have we heard anything about, you know, what exactly was happening last Monday?
So we haven't had any official announcement. Actually, it's a good question, but they haven't said anything. I think from what we can see on chain, I mean, they've been going to cash since late July. So it's been like 2 or 3 weeks that, you know, they've been selling a lot of their crypto positions. And this is not also, this is one of the reasons it's, you know, it's quite concerning, is that these are not like altcoins and very like, you know, risky assets. Those are, you know, it's ETH, like core positions, and basically going to USDT or USDC to cash like positions with stable coins. So there hasn't been any announcement, but yeah, on-chain data just, you know, shows us that that they've been going to cash for the past 2 or 3 weeks.
All right, so then maybe just last question here. Are they, do they know something the market doesn't, or are they in trouble, right? When you look at the crypto bull market that we've been in, you know, are they just saying, hey, this was the run, it's not going where everyone thinks, or you think this is firm specific?
Yeah, it's another good question. Yeah, this might be just, you know, them positioning for more downside, just like in crypto market and prices in general. And, you know, if, I mean, there are like, if you think about like the next, you know, 3 to 4 months in crypto, we still have, you know, Mt. Gox. We still have a lot of, you know, outflows from ETHI, from the Grayscale, you know, Ethereum trust that needs to be, that we need to go through. And so you have the elections, you know, now it seems like it's way closer between Trump and Kamala also. So I think there are a lot of, you know, potential volatility. So it could be that they're just positioning themselves, I guess, for more, for a larger, drawdown. I still think like selling those assets on Monday, was surprising. So the answer is, I don't know. But if you take, you know, what's happened like in the past, like year and a half, 2 years for Jump Crypto, it doesn't really paint a good picture, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Lorenzo, thank you so much for joining us. Maybe someone will make a market on Polymarket, whether they go bust by the end of the year or something, and we can track in real time.
Yeah, I'm sure it exists already. Thanks, guys.
See ya.
Thank you.
Mr. Wright's Law himself. You're back at it again with another cost decline, this time on electricity pricing in the U.S. Tee it up for us and then we'll get into it.
Sure. Wright's Law states that for every cumulative doubling of production, you get a fixed percent cost decline. You know, just to fill everyone in if they haven't been listening for the past 10 years here. But I thought this was particularly interesting. We were discussing all sorts of power and electrical usage needs. This really stemmed out of two lines of work that Daniel McGuire was researching. One, which was nuclear power, and then Frank, Joseph, and I were digging into, you know, the power demand from data centers. And so I was like, may as well see what the cost decline here is for electricity, because is it that critical for data centers from an operating cost perspective? Does it continue to go down? What does that even look like? And so was able to find and stitch together a number of various data sets. And since 1893 was the 93 was the first data point I had. And it was, you know, I think it was like $8 and something cents per kilowatt hour in 2023 dollars. And that cost has steadily come down through 1974, with the exception of World War II being a momentary blip upwards. And then since 1974, the cost of electricity in the US has been quite flat. And so then the question here is, you know, why is that the case? What happened there? And we think it is no coincidence that 1974 was the Energy Reorganization Act, which split the Atomic Energy Commission into the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the Energy Research and Development Administration. And Daniel did amazing work on this, looking at nuclear cost declines. And it's like nuclear rights law coming down, 1974, and then prices start going up. And so it is theoretically possible that killing nuclear in the US stopped the cost declines that we should have experienced.
So my first question here is, in different areas of the world, there's been different approaches to, you know, energy production. Nuclear, are there any countries where you can continue to track this cost decline because they were actually more progressive and less restrictive around nuclear? Or is this a worldwide phenomenon?
Yeah, so I think nuclear is also interesting from the cost decline perspective, because normally, say for lithium-ion batteries or anything that's more global, you get tech transfer and people leaving one company joining another. And so there can be a global cost decline curve because that those learnings tend to get shared. Nuclear, given the national security implications there and enriched uranium and all of that, each country does have its own cost decline for nuclear. And so Daniel, again, I'm quoting Daniel's work here, but you can see various countries. One that we will continue to look at, and the country that's still been investing the most, has been China. But, you know, cost data, I think, is a little bit harder to come by there. And so I think the analogy that we were discussing is similar to the space industry here, where it's like in 2005, the cost of a rocket was a fraction of what it was a decade later. And that was because, you know, there's a duopoly essentially for rocket launch. And so costs just ballooned. And then SpaceX came in, and they didn't come in at a revolutionary price. They just came in at the price that people were charging a decade earlier. And so there's the potential for this to happen, we think, with nuclear, where, you know, you've had prices skyrocket because people, regulators have been hindering the development, and large construction projects are quite difficult. And so now you've got a change in tune from regulators who are now, it seems to be encouraging it. You've got small modular reactors, which in theory should limit the complications that you get with a huge construction project. And so it's possible that someone could come in and the cost of nuclear in, I think this was like in the 1970s, was close to like $1,000 per kilowatt versus what Lazard quotes today, which is over $9,000 per kilowatt, I believe. So that you have this opportunity really to just go back and do what has already been done. And if you can execute on it, get a tremendous cost decline.
Is it that you can come in tomorrow and build this for, you know, $1,000 a kilowatt, or do you need laws and the regulatory stance to change? As in, you know, if there is a development that goes around maybe some of the guardrails that have been put into place that push out the costs, are those being taken down, or do you need something to happen on the regulatory front before you could actually, like, I hear what you're saying. Like, in theory, you could build one of these for $1,000 a kilowatt, but it's 9,000 today because of all of these regulatory hurdles. Are those still in place, or are they gone?
I would say they're slowly to quickly changing. And so right now I'd say we're in the company creation stage of these small modular reactors and various nuclear startups. And so all of them are eager because they see this changing tune from regulators and willingness to support these projects as opposed to tie them up in paperwork. And so that's the promising standpoint. You see companies excited by that. So you're getting a lot of people trying different approaches, which is great. Will all of them work? No, but that's fine, right? Part of the boom bust of a technology cycle is you get capital coming in. So society wins at large because lots of people are trying different things. And will this happen? Can you just go do it? No. It's like a lot of these companies' projects are planned for 2027 to 2030 as, you know, first build outs. And so I'd say it still remains to be seen who can execute on this. But in theory, someone who's a ruthless operator should be able to get down to similar costs that we've seen in the past. Will it be on their first plant? I would doubt that. Normally, you know, your first attempt at something is not going to go as smoothly as planned. But I think that it's reasonable to say that within a decade, it's possible.
And why are the projects not slated to start for another 2.5, 3 years? Are they waiting and hoping, you know, some regime change happens and you have all of these laws that are in place stricken from the record or, you know, repealed?
No, they're going through the process now. So okay. It's like everyone's working to go through the regulators, get approved, and then, you know, it's a construction project. So construction still takes time.
Gotcha. Interesting.
Yeah. So, and I would say another thing people often ask is about, you know, solar and wind. And we certainly are fans of solar, wind, and batteries. Those have experienced quite dramatic cost declines themselves. They are intermittent though. And they also have, you know, like utility solar also has a capital cost of around $1,000 per kilowatt. But the difference is, you know, solar can be utilized around 23-ish% of the time. Nuclear can be utilized 80% plus of the time. And so you get a difference in levelized cost of electricity that's lower for nuclear. Batteries also coming down, right? You pair intermittent solar and wind with batteries, and that can become more baseload. But right now, that's still more expensive.
And I understand why it would be intermittent on wind and solar. Nuclear obviously much higher, but where is that other 20% of time going?
It can be even higher, right? In theory, it should be close 100. To, yeah. But I'm just quoting, you know, the traditional assumption for nuclear is around 80%. Even, you know, looking at Frank's work for data center uptime around that 80% plus mark, just on average across.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
Short, so, sweet episode.
Keeping it snappy.
Yeah. All right. We'll see everyone next week.
All right. See ya.
See ya.